Hey girl, welcome to the Empower Her podcast, where we are all about taking purpose-driven action toward building lives we really freaking love. My name's Keisha, and I'm a saucy 29-year-old who left the corporate world to go on to build a seven-figure online business. But most days, I still feel like I have no clue what I'm doing, but I'm obsessed with the process of us getting to figure it out together. We've got epic guests, incredible stories, tips, and tricks to help us get out of our own way and unapologetically make some moves. So girlfriend, let's do the damn thing. Hey girl, I'm so excited that you're here today because on the show we have Erin Laurie, who is a millennial personal finance expert, author, and speaker. And what's cool is I had asked on Instagram about different topics that you really wanted to hear on the show, and a lot came up about finances. So I wanted to find someone who is extremely educated. Erin has appeared on CBS Sunday Morning, CNBC, Fox and Friends. She's written for Fast Company, Cosmo, Refinery 29. She speaks at universities and conferences around the country. She knows her stuff. And she also started the personal finance blog called The Broke Millennial, which she then expanded into two different books so far. One about The Broke Millennial, Stop Scraping By and Get Your Financial Life Together, which was in 2017. And her second book is The Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, A Beginner's Guide to Leveling Up in Your Money. But what I really loved about her is her content is so refreshing. She's got a lot of strong opinions, but at the same time, she really caters it through storytelling and narratives and takes this really complex jargon of finances and makes it very simple, but also talks about this in a way that I think really hits home with this demographic. And in this interview, we talk a lot about the mindset behind finances. We talk a lot about different studies and different debt and ways to approach finances. And it's really interesting and also light and fun. So I really think you're going to like it. I can't wait to hear what you think about this different style of interview. So be sure to take us on Instagram when you check it out, myself and at The Broke Millennial. And without further ado, let's dive right in. Erin, I'm so excited that you're here. Welcome to the show, girl.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to dig into a lot of the mindset around like some of the financial choices that we're making. And you have so much tangible advice through your books, through YouTube, through your social media. So I just feel like you are a content machine. But before you got to this place, I want to take it back a little bit and talk about how in the world did you make a career out of this? And where did this idea start from?
I'm as surprised as anyone else. I'll be totally honest with you. I love to talk about the fact that if you told 10-year-old, 18-year-old, even like 22-year-old Erin that this was going to be my trajectory, I definitely would have just laughed in your face. So just be open to possibilities is always my advice to high school and college kids because you just never know. Man, how I got here, it's a bit of a long, winding road, but the shortest version is essentially my background is more in the journalism theater arena. I love storytelling. I love anything narrative, which very much comes out in my work from anybody that's familiar with me or follows me. And long story short, the time that Broke Millennial became an inspiration piece was back in, well, it was the end of 2012. It started in January of 2013, but at the end of 2012, I had lived in New York for a full year at that point, and I was out for, well, I had been out partying with a friend of mine, and we were having that, you know, 2 a.m. cup of coffee, if you will, and we were just talking kind of about the state of our lives. We both had moved to New York interested in entertainment. We met working a job in entertainment. That job kind of made me feel like, not really the career path I think that I want. And I also wanted stability. My first year in New York, I worked three different jobs, made a whopping $23,000. And wow. At that point in time, I just wanted a regular paycheck, health benefits, a 401k. Like that seems so sexy to me. Mm-hmm. And I went that route. And I, at the time, was working in public relations. It wasn't the perfect fit. We'll get to that. And I know I said long story short. It's just going to be long story long. And I was talking to my friend, and she had moved to New York to be an actress, classic tale, but she wasn't trying. She, at the time, was working as an executive assistant at a very big media company and complained about it constantly. And I said, you know, I don't totally understand why you don't find a job that makes it more compatible for you to go out on auditions, nannying, waitressing, babysitting, so many options to make ends meet. She was also a woman who had no student loan debt, no credit card debt, came from a family with means, so worst case scenario, they could bail her out. I mean, she was in just the most perfect position to go after what she wanted. She looked at me and she goes, money just really stresses me out. All I do is hope I have enough at the end of the month. And that blew my mind. And trust me, I know how naive that sounds now. But at the time, yeah, we were 23. I had really grown up in an environment where my family talked about money constantly in a very healthy way. It was just something that got discussed. I understood how it worked. Even when I wasn't making enough money, I still felt very much in control of my money because I had that mindset. It all comes back to mental things.
Yeah.
And her saying that to me and me also knowing how much privilege she came from, and I do as well, I was like, what the what? How can you come from this background and be this confused about money? So then got me thinking and I started asking around and talking to friends and cousins and coworkers, and no one wanted to talk about money. And that's what really inspired BrokeMillennial.com is I wanted to create a place where I started talking about my own relationship to money, stories about money, how I was handling my finances. Again, this is 2013. Blogging was still somewhat trendy. So now I guess it would be a podcast or a YouTube channel. And I was also one of the few people in the personal finance space that was at the time single, as in not married. I did have a boyfriend, but single. And I was also in a long distance relationship, living in an urban environment. You know, it was very traditional, like man living with his wife in the Midwest with their 2.5 kids. Like that was a lot of the rhetoric in the personal finance sphere at the time, which I think is part of what really made Broke Millennial stand out, as well as it was just very narrative. I always came from that place. It never was, you know, it was always just kind of a passion fun project. It never really was an intention of mine to make it this big thing. I'm so grateful it has. But it just sort of spiraled out of this place of me just wanting to share and talk about money. And as a journalism theater double major out of college, being like, listen, if I can figure this out, anyone can figure this out.
Yes, I love that. And I think you just created your own lane, which is really inspiring to the woman listening to this that's nervous about what's next. It's like there's so much of that that came from following your intuition, but also seeing a need for this. No one was like a broke millennial, right? For sake of the name, that was talking about this. So you're just like, you know what? This needs to be done with a different style. It needs to be done my way. So I love that. And I think just the story of kind of even getting towards that and where you're at now is so inspiring. So that being said, you obviously have amazing content in terms of like really nitty gritty financial stuff. But what I'm really interested in is a lot of the other content that you weave into everything that you do around like personality types and kind of why we make some of these buying decisions or saving decisions or YOLO. I wrote down one, YOLO FOMO. Like some of the terms that you use are so attractive to me as a 29-year-old as well. So talk to us about kind of like personality types and this in particular, I know you have a YouTube video about three different personality types and kind of how we approach money. So can we dive into a little bit of that?
We can. And there's so much more than that. I kind of distilled it for the sake of my first book, Broke Millennial, Stop Screaming Buy and Get Your Financial Life Together. I will say, if you want to like really do a deep dive that is actually researched, Bradley Klontz. Check him out, Dr. Brad Klontz. He's a financial psychologist and he has done a ton of work about money disorders and he calls them money scripts. So I found that later on after I had kind of devised this first thing. So now I love referring people to him. But one of the things that inspired what you're talking about is I used to work at a company called Magnify Money. And when I worked there, we did a study with Dr. Philip Zimbardo. So anybody who studies psychology, if you remember the Stanford Prison Experiment, Philip Zimbardo, Stanford Prison Experiment fame. And he has this whole idea around what he calls the time paradox, which is essentially your relationship to time very much impacts how you act day to day. And I know that sounds kind of funky, but essentially, are you focused in the past? And if you are, was it the glory days or was it really negative? Or are you somebody that's very much that carpe diem, to use the classic term, YOLO, to use the current term? Are you all about living in the present? Everything's just about pleasure today, no thought of the future, not dwelling on the past. That he calls present hedonists. And then if you look towards the future, there are people who are just so focused on the future that it's really sort of to the detriment of themselves today. So I riffed on this study and kind of grouped millennials into three common categories. One, it's probably the most prevalent, is YOLO, FOMO. And it's the people who are very much like, drinks are on me. Don't worry if I have an overdraft charge. I'll figure out retirement 10 years from now. Like, if any of those scripts have gone through your head at any point, you're probably YOLO FOMO. Then you do have the people that are, I call them the delusional optimist, or guarded optimist, really, is the nicer term. People who think like, yeah, you know, I'll be fine in like 10 years. I'm definitely going to be making like $250,000, even if you're in a profession where that's not realistic, but you're the person who thinks like, I'm going to be making good money. It'll all sort itself out. I'm very optimistic about the future. And then there's the people who are dreaming about retirement. We've seen the rise in the FIRE movement recently, which those people all get lumped into that category. But it's folks that are like so dogmatically focused on the future that oftentimes it's to the detriment of their present selves. And they might be failing to invest in relationships, to live in the moment and create memories now, because everything financially is in the pursuit of this future version of themselves. So those are kind of the three main groups. There are so many more. There are so many like actual professional studies that have been done to talk about money scripts and money disorders. But this really, I liked the idea of riffing on that time paradox, because truly, I think it's very true. I have my entire life been a very future-oriented individual. Even my mom did the famous marshmallow test on me as a child, where you put a marshmallow down, tell a kid if they don't touch it for 3 minutes, they'll get a second one. Sat there and stared at it the whole time. My sister, she picked it up, she licked it, she put it in her mouth, take it out. So she found the loophole. She didn't technically eat it, but she also enjoyed it in the moment, where I was just like sitting there on my hands staring at it. But delayed gratification has always been part of just innately who I am. I was the kid that wanted to open presents later in the day on my birthday. I made Christmas morning stretch out as long as possible. I just loved the delay, something about my wiring. So wow. I very much fall into the future-oriented grouping, but that also means it's been to the detriment of my present self at different points in my life. And I often look back on my early 20s as a time where I failed to invest in relationships because I was so focused on making money. If there was an opportunity to pick up an extra shift or to go get a babysitting gig, I would say no to every social invitation in pursuit of financial means. Mm-hmm. And realized in my mid-20s, oh, that's why those friendships didn't progress, because I didn't take the time to invest in them. So there has to be a balance.
Right. Oh, I love that. And I think once you're aware and you kind of start to think about it, of course, there's lots of studies that you've referenced, and everyone can go check out your book. But I think it's really powerful that once you're aware, you actually can take action in some regard. But so often we're not really thinking about these narratives that we're telling ourselves about money or even how we're approaching things. So I know you use a lot of this to kind of help people like budget and kind of figure out how to pay off debt. So do you want to talk to us about maybe some of your best like tips for paying off debt and for budgeting in general, based off of kind of how we approach life maybe?
Sure. Well, the first thing that you have to do is kind of the hard work of identifying what is your emotional relationship to money.
Yeah.
So when you think about money, what's the first instincts that you're having? For some people, they feel empowered and in control, and they look at it as a positive thing. For others, they don't want to check their bank accounts. They don't want to touch it. They don't want to think about it. Like my friend that I referenced earlier, most of the time, that reaction is completely rooted in our childhood. Because studies have shown by the ages of between 8 and 10, we've really kind of coded our relationship with money based on what we're raised around. So in your household, how was money talked about? What were you told about money? Was it a source of stress and tension? Were you embarrassed by your family's financial situation compared to people around you? All of those types of questions are really important to start reflecting on, including my favorite, what is your first money memory? It usually really links to how you feel about money today. And you have to start to do this introspective work in order to identify your current financial relationship and then create the strategies to protect yourself from yourself, as I like to say. So I know a woman, for instance, who grew up in a lot of what she would identify as financial chaos. Her family was kind of in and out of, I don't know that she would necessarily use the word poverty, but definitely either lower middle class to lower class. Paying the bills were hard at certain times, and then they would come into money for a little bit of time, and then they would kind of blow it all. So as an adult, like well into adulthood, not early 20s, she still will manifest these behaviors because even though she knows it's rather toxic, it's what she's comfortable with and it's what she knows. So as soon as money comes in, she's spending it. And she continues to put herself in this cycle of stress and chaos, but it's her comfort zone, as odd as that sounds to people.
Yeah.
And you then, once you start to identify that though, how do you get past it? Beyond maybe meeting with a therapist or a financial therapist, depending on the extent of the situation. There's also little systems you can put in place. So one that I like to recommend to people is super simple. Nickname your savings accounts. Most banks will allow you to go in and change from like savings account number 567301 or what have you to something very specific. And the more specific you can get, the better. So for instance, my husband and I are saving up to take a trip to South Africa next July. So South Africa, July 2020, you got the place, you've got a timeline attached to it. Mm-hmm. So now when I log into my bank account, yeah, I could be tempted to skim a little money out of that fund for something today, but the name immediately reminds me, this is why you're saving.
Yeah.
Is it going to totally prevent you from doing it? No, but it throws up that little psychological block, which is really helpful.
Mm-hmm. And it makes it fun. I did that for one of my accounts. Forget we're getting married next October. And it's like, let's get married. Yo, yo, woo. And it makes me excited to put money in it versus feeling like it's like eating away at my money. So yeah. I love that tip. So good.
Anytime you can emotionally connect like that, especially in a positive way, it's really helpful. If you want to quit your job, having a date, a deadline that you want to put on that and put it on the savings account, like job fund or like F you with the name of your boss, make sure they don't see your account, like whatever it is, doing things like that, really, it's all about the psychology at that point. It really does help. Another very small tactic is to do out of sight, out of mind, although I kind of hate the idea of money being out of mind, but quote unquote, out of sight, out of mind with your savings account, where you could do your main checking at one bank and then have the bulk of your savings at a completely separate bank. So when you log in to do your checking, pay your bills, take money out for budgeting, whatever, you're not even seeing your savings. And then on the back end, if there's a day, like an indulgence tonight, it usually takes 2 to 3 business days for your money to transfer over. So, oh well, can't pull it out of there anyway.
Yeah. Ooh, so smart. I love that. So, okay. One of the questions that you just said, you know, of what's your first early money memory? I'm thinking of the woman who's listening to this right now that's kind of trying to identify what is the actual story that I'm telling myself and is that story serving me? And if it's not, how can I change that story? So I know you mentioned like thinking of early childhood memories. Are there any other like questions that you found to be helpful when you're talking with friends or clients or anyone that you've researched for this book to help them determine kind of maybe what might be holding them back from the money story that they're telling themselves that could serve them?
Yeah, there's a whole inventory in my first book about the questions that it's good for you to ask yourself, starting with what's your first money memory. And then they also include things like, what did my parents tell me about money? How did I get money growing up? So were you a kid that got allowance? Did you have to do chores to get allowance? Were you just handed money when you needed it? Were you told there's no extra money, so don't ask? Like, what were you told about that? Mm-hmm. I always love to telling adults, try to remember when you were a kid. And I feel like we all at some point asked mom and or dad, how much do you make? That's a very natural question to ask as a child. And if you can remember asking that question, do you remember the response? Were you told that's rude? Don't ask that. We don't talk about that. It's rude to ask people about money. And so is that giving you a messaging of it being taboo or dirty? All of those types of scenarios, you know, gifting at the holidays, what was that experience like when you went to a friend's house? Were you self-conscious about what your family had in comparison or didn't have in comparison? All of these kind of scripts that we're getting. And another thing I like to tell people to think about is what were the, when you did have money as a kid, so whether you worked for it or made it, got an allowance or what have you, what did you spend your money on? What as a child did you value? Or what were you kind of instructed to value perhaps from your parents? Because that also can play out into our adulthood. And I think it's really interesting to reflect back on those early financial decisions that we're making. And I know I might be kind of an oddball about it, but there are some purchases that I can just so vividly remember making. Mm-hmm. One of them, and I think that this ties into the fact that I hate clothing shopping now as an adult, but as a kid, it was third grade, so this would have been like 1997, 98. And clogs were like a really big thing yes. at the time. Everybody was wearing clogs. And I went to a Catholic school, so we had uniforms, but they had not yet banned the clog. And I was so excited. I saved up my money. I used to cat sit for like this demonic cat that lived next door. So when my neighbor went out of town, I would go feed it and like clean out the litter box. So I saved up that money and I went to buy a pair of clogs from Payless. They were blue felt or like whatever that material was. They had a little trim around them. My mom's like, I'm not buying these. You'll grow out of them in like 4 weeks. This is not, I'm not paying for that. I think they cost me like $13.95. I was so excited. I wore them to school one time and then the school bans them and says that they're not part of the uniform.
Oh.
So that gave me like a very bad feeling about buying clothes. And I also have a memory of being a little kid and getting a Lion King belt. And again, wear it to school and they're like, no girl, not part of the uniform. It has to be a black or a brown belt. So anytime I tried to assert any sort of choice of fashion, I was completely shut down as a child. And so even now I'm like, this is crippling. I don't like having to make these choices.
Oh my gosh, that's actually so interesting though. So, okay, can you tell us a little bit, what I really like about your style, just being really frank, is I love how much knowledge you have and how educated you are and you know your ish, but also this narrative element where like, it's so fun to listen to you and like you really just tie it all together because so many people learn so much better from stories and you take this complex jargon that I feel like is like thrown at our faces sometimes and you simplify it, but in a meaningful way. So I love that. So can you talk a little bit about why you wrote the first book and kind of what an overview of the first book? And then I want to talk about the second one too.
The first one is really meant to be a complete beginner's guide to just getting your financial life together from I start with the psychology, thinking about how we think about money. Yep. And move you into the basics like budgeting. Everybody hates the B word. So I rebranded it to cash flow and talking about cash flow, how to get control of your money, different techniques, then, you know, credit scoring, paying off debt, handling student loans. And then we get into more things like how to talk to your friends about money. Call that chapter, I Can't Afford to Split This Dinner Bill Evenly, because we have all been there.
Yeah.
And you know, getting financially naked with your partner. I love talking about how to talk about money, which is the entire topic of my third book. Then also negotiating, buying a house, very beginning investing is in book one. And my vision for that book was you're not meant to read it cover to cover. It's there with you as you progress in your journey. It's each chapter stands on its own. So if you've got certain things on lock, skip that chapter, move right along. I even try to identify that for you early on in the book. Like, hey, if this is your situation, jump to chapters 6, 7, 8, 9. If this is your situation, read 1 through 3. And my early joke about it was you could go to the bathroom, read a chapter. It's very short and self-contained. And you learn something about money. Like I wanted it to essentially be a bathroom read. That was really the goal. Each chapter starts with a narrative tale. I weave something usually personal into how I learned about this particular thing. And then I interview a ton of people for all of my books because, like I said, journalism and theater background. Yeah. So I didn't work on Wall Street. I didn't work in banking. I did work for a financial services technology company. So I have worked kind of in the industry, but not in the like, hey, I'm a certified financial planner. Not my case. Right. So I like to go interview those very smart people and then figure out a way to distill their knowledge. In the second book, I refer to myself as a translator. I think that's the most accurate way to describe what I do. And like you said, I appreciate you saying I'm very knowledgeable. It's a lot of just research. And again, proof point that if I can figure this out, you can figure this out.
Yes, I love that. And so why do you think, just your personal opinion, why do you think it is that so many millennials, or even just like 20, 30 something year olds, why do we avoid learning about this topic? So like, I appreciate that you do so much research and you put it into this very digestible content, but why do you think as a whole that the majority of us don't spend time learning more about this?
No one ever tells us how and when we're supposed to learn. It's just this life skill that all of a sudden we're magically supposed to have acquired at some point. Just like learning how to cook. Like if you never got taught how to do that growing up and then you get thrust on living on your own, it's like, oh crap, I have to figure out how to cook now. It takes some time. Things don't taste great in the beginning, but you just keep reading and learning and practicing and you get good. Very similar. It's a life skill set that is imperative, but it's like parents assume school's going to teach you and school assumes parents are going to teach you. There just doesn't seem to be people talking about, hey, at what point is this important?
Yeah.
Because it is critical. And again, we get all of this language and all this messaging so early on in our lives about like, this is inappropriate. You don't talk about this. You don't ask about this. So then you reach a point, usually in your early 20s, where you're like, I don't know how to do this, but apparently everyone else does. So I feel like the idiot over here in the corner, and now I'm embarrassed to even ask someone for help. Yeah. Or the only people I feel comfortable asking are my parents, and they do not know what they're doing. Like that's a very common situation. Mm-hmm. Or maybe your parents feel embarrassed and don't want to talk to you about it. I mean, there's just no easy answer.
Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons. And I just truly think a huge part of it is this disconnect of, we're not supposed to talk about it. Therefore, let's not talk about it. I mean, heck, there's all of this proof that people are more likely to talk about their sexual desires and partners than they are to share their student loan debt, which is just bananas that we're more comfortable with things that a generation ago were crazy taboo.
Yeah.
And money is still the like big, dirty elephant in the room.
So interesting. I love just like the mindset part behind that. So, okay, for the woman that's listening to this right now that is in a lot of debt, right? Of variations of different types of debt, whether that's student loans or credit card debts and all of that. What are a couple of different ways that she could approach tackling debt without getting too nitty gritty, but more like high level if she's just like kind of feeling that overwhelmed feeling?
So the very first thing to do is the hardest thing, and that is you have to face your numbers. When you get yourself into a debt situation, regardless, student loans, credit cards, auto loans, all of the above, it gets really overwhelming. So a lot of people's strategy is just to pay the minimums due and try not to think about it.
Yeah.
Which is really the worst strategy to have, because you have to have all of the information in order to make any sort of plan. And all of the information includes exactly how much you owe, who you owe it to, what the interest rate is, and what your minimum payments are. So sit down, make a list of all that information. And truly, this is the most painful part because you have to face it now. Yeah. And I would say in tandem, I have a slightly different approach than some of the other older personal finance experts. There tends to be a lot of like, embrace the shame, you should feel bad, don't ever do this to yourself again rhetoric around it. I'm much more of the like, look at it, evaluate it, you've made this decision and or mistake. And sometimes it wasn't a mistake, sometimes it was like, hey, I had a health crisis and I had to finance it on a credit card, this is what happened.
Yep.
That's also a very common reason for debt. So whatever the reason, we are looking at the numbers, it happened, let's forgive ourselves and move the F on, because it is, I think, a waste of mental bandwidth and energy to be stewing in the shame spiral that is so common.
Yeah.
So now that we have the information, we can make a plan. And two key things that I would recommend people can Google, I can send you links to share in show notes, looking up what is often called the debt avalanche and the debt snowball strategies of paying down debt. So I'll start with debt snowball. It tends to be the more popular one. Anyone listening, if you've heard of Dave Ramsey, that's what he talks about all the time. I'm not going down this rabbit hole, but this is the one thing that I would say he does a good job with. Let's just leave it at that. And so Dave Ramsey talks about the debt snowball. He really kind of popularized this as a strategy. Basically, what you do is you list all of your debts, not paying attention to the interest rates. You're just paying attention to how much you owe, and you write them down from the smallest debt to the largest debt. Now, when you do that, you also need to make sure you're noting the minimum amount due on all of them. No matter which style you're doing, always pay at least the minimum amount on all of your debts, because if you don't, then you're going to go into default. It's going to really crush your credit score. So don't miss a payment. So let's say that you've got four different types of debts, like three credit cards and a student loan, just throwing out some things, and that you took all the minimum due. It's like, okay, I owe $300 a month on all of these debts, but I can afford to put $400 a month towards them. I looked at my budget, I ran the numbers, I can pull an extra $100 out of my budget to put towards my debt. So you're going to take that extra $100 and you're going to apply it to the smallest balance debt that you have. It's harder to hear this. I write about it in my book. I have a video that I'll share that actually shows numbers on the screen. So you take that extra money, you apply it to your smallest balance. This is in debt snowball. And you keep making that payment every month, every month. And you're going to start to see real movement happening, because every time you pay even a little bit above the minimum due on a debt, it starts to attack the principal balance. If you're just paying the minimum due, you're kind of just paying interest. And that's why you get that feeling of, oh my God, this is never going down. Why is my debt not going away? So with snowball, you attack, you finish that smallest debt. Now you're going to take the minimum amount you're paying on that and apply it to your next smallest debt. And you're going to go from small up to large. And at the end, you're going to be putting all $400 a month toward your final debt. So that's debt snowball. The premise is really, you're making your brain happy, is what I like to call it, because it's easier to pay off those smaller debts. So you get those little wins along the way, encourages you to keep moving forward. Debt avalanche, what we're focusing on is the interest rate. It's the pure mathematical play to paying down debt, because you're going from highest interest rate to lowest interest rate, knocking out the highest interest rate debt first. You're not paying attention to the principal balance of each of the debts. You're paying attention to the interest rates. And the reason that some people trip up on this is because it can take a while to pay off that first debt. So it can get a little demoralizing along the way. And that's why usually snowball is the recommended strategy. Because while with debt avalanche, you save more money because you pay less in interest, with debt snowball, I think the success rate is a little bit higher. And at the end of the day, the goal is to get debt free. So if you pay a little extra in interest, but you still get debt free, that's a win. So like I said, I know it sounds confusing to audibly be hearing these structures. So I'll send a link to, I did a video on this on the YouTube channel that you can check out, or just Google the terms debt avalanche, debt snowball. There's so much information about both of them on the internet.
And I think just even having that jargon, like of those two different types, kind of gives you like, I could take this path or this path. And then asking yourself like what feels like it's going to help me stay consistent. Cause I think the snowball thing, like I love that because it gives you that confidence deposit every single time you see that number drop. And knowing my own personality, I'm like, oh, I'm for sure snowballing. Like I'm not doing this like avalanche thing. I want to do the snowball cause it sounds a lot more fun and it sounds like it's going to be more fulfilling in the process. So it's like, that's where, you know, the woman listening to this in Trader Joe's right now, if you're like, okay, snowball, like that, I feel like I can handle that. Or maybe you're someone who's like, go for like the avalanche. I just think it's important to take your personality into consideration. And that's what I love so much about your content. That's very different from a lot of like, maybe, you know, older, I guess to use age as it older, like more kind of stuck in their ways of what's worked 30 years ago. You're really applying to like the modern day, you know, person who's kind of trying to navigate this like fast paced society and also doing things that, you know, are going to feel good in the process as much as they can.
And it's also, and to that point, I'm an avalanche style girl because I'm very motivated by numbers. Shocking. Yeah. Money motivates me. So the idea of saving money to me is a big motivator. So when we started tackling my husband's student loans, I'm like, we're avalanching this.
Yes.
And you know, it just totally depends on your personality type. And I will also say the reason I always like to present multiple options is because, to borrow the cliche, personal finance is nothing if not personal. What works for me is not necessarily what's going to work for absolutely everybody. So I think it is very helpful to give people steps and prescriptive guides, but I like to offer a lot of different alternatives so you can choose the version and create your own path that's going to fit best, because really otherwise it's going to set certain people up for failure. Because if we don't think the same way, if we're not motivated in similar ways, then my way is not going to be the ideal way. So I'd rather you have several options and can piece together, this is what works best for me.
Yes. And I mean, to your point, I'm getting so excited about this small, like, woo, like I'm going to get to celebrate all the time. And you're like, what makes most logical sense? And this makes more sense. We're going to save more this way. And we're completely motivated differently. And I think that's so powerful that we just saw that in real time, where I'm like getting like sweaty, excited about this snowball thing. And you're like, I want to avalanche all the student loans. So I think that's really cool. On that, one quick question before I ask you a little bit more about your advice is, what would be your take to the person who has credit card debt and student loan debt and they feel like it's kind of both crippling? Would you still say approach it in a way like avalanche versus snowball, or do you think that one debt is worse or better than the other?
I would get rid of the credit card debt ASAP. Every extra dollar that you have, again, pay the minimums due on your student loans, but every extra dollar you can come up with, throw it at the credit card debt. And the reason being, I mean, it depends, because a lot of student loan debt, you might be in like 50K of student loan debt, but that's probably 8 different student loans. So if you wrote it out in terms of the snowball, the student loans might be less than the credit card debt. You might have $12,000 on one credit card, but your student loans might be like 6, 8, 7, whatever it is. Credit card interest rates are so horrifically high. Mm-hmm. Especially if you have one with the name of a store brand on the front of your card, you're probably looking at 27 to 30% interest rate. On average, we're between, and this isn't really an average, the range really is about 15% up to about 30% for American credit cards, which is just out of control.
So crazy.
So if you are sitting on credit card debt at a, let's say, 22% interest rate, crush it as fast as you possibly can, because the amount of money that's being wasted in interest, again, this goes back to my avalanche style, but it just makes more sense to get rid of that fast. And if your student loans are federal, there are simply more options for you. You could, if you run into a tough time, put them in deferment or forbearance, depending on the situation. I just feel like it's, you know, you've got income-driven repayment plans. You can, it's not refinancing, that's a separate thing, but you could put them on an income-driven repayment plan. So your monthly payment is prorated based on your income. Credit card companies don't care. You owe it, you owe.
Yep.
So get rid of it.
Ooh, good advice. Okay, last question before I move into the final two questions is, what would be just one like piece of advice or anything that you would want to say to the woman listening to this who feels a little bit stuck and overwhelmed that could kind of just empower her to start making some financial choices or creating more financial awareness? Do you have anything you want to say to her?
The first thing is going back to the idea of facing your numbers, but across the board. So all of your debt numbers, you need to run what I call your cash flow budget. How much money is coming in and how much money is going out every single month. So you sit down and look at if it's one income stream with one day job, or if you're working multiple jobs, have a side hustle, whatever, how much money is coming in, and then write a list of every single expense that you have in the month and do the math. Are you bringing in more money than is going out, or are you working at a negative number? Because that also is going to inform a lot of the decisions that you're making in the future as well. So facing those numbers, you cannot make any decisions or move forward with any sort of plan without that very granular, nitty-gritty information. And I know it can be painful and it can be a little bit stressful. Pop a bottle of wine if you need to do it. Have an accountability buddy, which is an incredibly helpful way. Find a friend who's willing to go on this journey with you. Do it with a romantic partner. Do it with a sibling. Have someone that you can talk to. And if you want to remain anonymous, there is a huge community now of personal finance bloggers, podcasters. So go find the person that fits you. So if the way I've been talking, you're like, yeah, I'm not really clicking with this, that's fine. There are so many people out there. So just keep dabbling until you find that one person who is just, they get you, you are connected to them. Everything they say, you're like, this is exactly how I feel. That is really, really important, to find the person that inspires you to get in control of your money.
Ooh, so good. Okay. I like to ask every guest on this show, this is two parts. One is we have a Spotify playlist for this podcast. This is such a curveball. You're probably like, what? For pump up jams. So I'm going to want to know one of your pump up jams that you want to add to that. It can be anything. It's literally gone from show tunes to like really gangster rap. And number two, what do you do personally if you're feeling stuck and you need to take action? Whether that's you need to go write a blog, you need to get ready for an interview, you need to create content for one of your courses, whatever it may be. If you feel kind of stuck, what do you personally do to get yourself to take action?
Okay, first, I'm pulling it up. I have a Broke Millennial playlist on Spotify. So anyone yes! listening, there is a playlist called Broke Millennial.
So good.
With okay. the logo of my first book on it. That I came up with for my very first book launch party. And now if it's allowed to be in an environment where there are swears, because there are some rap songs on here.
That, yes.
You know. So I was just kind of scrolling down this, trying to be like, what is my favorite money-related song? I don't know that there's just so many. I feel like I don't have one that's like particularly money-related. I would just say right now for a pump-up jam, like anything by Lizzo at the moment. I'm yes. just like here for all of that.
She's so good.
She's so good. I just feel like everything that she sings, I'm like, yeah, I feel so yeah. pumped up right
like
now.
Like Lizzo, good as hell for you. Like, yeah, money. Woo, cash flow instead of budget. Yeah. Let's go.
I'll also say like Cardi B's Money. Is another if you want like something to just feel
that's good.
Pumped
that's
up
perfect.
To. And then I have a really rando one that I don't know, a lot of people might not have heard about this, but there's a rapper, his name is D1, D-E-E/1. And he has a song called Sally Mae Back, and it's about paying Sally Mae back and him getting debt free. And I'm just going to like play a little bit of it. I don't know how well you're going to be able to hear it. But... This is a real song.
Wait,
I love
amazing.
It so much.
Okay, I am here for it.
The
so
whole
good.
Thing, and you got to watch the YouTube video because it's him like going in and paying off his student loan. It's so funny.
Okay,
like,
we will link that for sure. Oh. Just for a little comedic, I feel like that could be really funny too.
And I have that like on deck, ready to go the day we make the last payment on our student loans. Be like, yeah.
You and your dog.
We're
and
done.
And you're just going to be like twerking around your apartment. I love
yeah,
that.
It's going to be great. So that's a very inspirational when you're feeling down about paying down off your student loans. There's literally a rap song for you.
There you go. Okay. And then when you're needing to take action for yourself.
I think for me, a lot of times is that I have to take a break. Mm-hmm. And I am a chronic workaholic who has problems disconnecting. So it's anytime people talk about like, you put out a lot of content. I'm like, because I don't stop working. It's a problem. And for me, a big part of that is I have dealt with very severe burnout in a couple of cases, and knowing how to set boundaries now for myself and learning how to say no is really the better way for me to then get into a headspace to be able to produce that kind of content. I'm also a bad procrastinator, guys. It's so funny. I think people are like, oh, you put out so much stuff. You're so prolific with this. I'm like, yeah, because I have deadlines. Like, if I didn't have externally imposed deadlines, I don't know if I would get anything done.
So good, though. That's really yeah. helpful for people that struggle with, like, why can't I do this? It's like, oh, well, you're not giving yourself deadlines.
You or, like, have an editor or have a someone or a client who's like, I'm not going to get paid if I don't send this to them. Or, yeah. you know, if you're completely self-employed with no, I don't know how you don't have clients or anything, but if you, yeah. if you need someone else, having a mastermind group is incredibly helpful. And whether or not you're traditionally employed or self-employed, having a group of people, really when you're traditionally employed, it's like mentors. But when you're self-employed, finding those people can be a lot harder. So mastermind groups are really people who, in a similar field of what you're doing, doesn't necessarily have to be the exact same thing, who can help hold you accountable. Mine meets once a week for 2 hours. We do these hot seats where we come to the group with maybe a problem. We help creatively problem solve. We tell each other our goals. We're checking in on each other once a week and like, how's that going? Did you actually do this? And having that kind of external accountability buddy is a huge help because, listen, there's so much of this hustle porn is what I like to call it now on social media. was like, you just need to grind. You just need to work harder. I'm like, no, I want wine in Real Housewives. Like, that is really at the end of the day what I'm working towards. And sometimes I just want to be in sweats on my couch. So I do try to weave that narrative into a lot of my social media stuff. It's like, listen, I know how cool this work looks, but can we talk about what's happening in the background?
Love
when
it.
I was on my book tour, 9 cities in 6 weeks, many of the events sold out. It was amazing, but I also was exhausted. I wasn't eating well, gained a bunch of weight during that period of time because of the exhaustion and not eating well, wasn't getting to see my friends. I was fairly newly married and I felt like I wasn't having any time to invest into my brand new marriage. It's just a lot of other things are happening then behind the scenes mm-hmm. that's important to talk about.
Yes. Oh, so powerful.
And okay. It's not complaining. It's just being like, this is the reality of the situation.
And that's what we need right now, right? It's just more realness about it. So I love that so much. So for the woman listening to this that just like needs to get your content, needs to connect with you, where can we find you? What are you excited about? Give us your rundown.
Well, you can find brokemillennial.com. I'll be honest, I don't blog a whole lot anymore, but there's a huge backlog there of content. My books, Broke Millennial and Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, are available wherever books are sold. And check your library. And if it's not there, you can request it because then you can get it for free.
Yeah.
And definitely connect with me on social media. I'm on Twitter at Broke Millennial, and I'm quite prolific on Instagram at Broke Millennial Blog. And every single Wednesday, I do an Ask Me Anything. So if you have a question, you can go submit it on Wednesdays, and I try to answer at least 10 up to 15 questions every week. And I look to group themes together. So if, you know, everybody's asking about one particular thing, I always answer that question.
I love that. And it's so good because you really break down answers. Like, these are stuff that you have to screenshot because it's like paragraphs. It's so good. So thank you for how you're showing up. I seriously appreciate it. And you're helping so many freaking people. So to tie this all up at the very end, any last little nugget or a quote that you want to share or anything that you want to leave the audience with that's on your heart?
I would say my money mantra is very simple. Either you control money or money controls you. And my goal is to just make sure that you're in control. And truthfully, it doesn't matter how much you earn. Obviously, if you earn more, it's easier to break out of the paycheck to paycheck cycle if your lifestyle is within that. You'd be shocked how many people making 6 figures are living paycheck to paycheck. Mm-hmm. But even if you feel like, oh, I just don't make enough, it is possible still to take that control. But you have to put yourself in the driver's seat by doing the hard work of both educating yourself and then being introspective about what it's going to take in order to do that.
I love it. Thank you so much, Erin.
Thank you.
I appreciate you being with us and sharing so much insight with us. Just keep doing it. I'm going to be fangirling so hard, cheering you on. You're incredible. So thank you so much, girl.
Thanks. And thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. If you love this episode, I would so appreciate it if you share with your girlfriends, or better yet, post it on Instagram stories and tag me. Then I can personally say thank you for helping me get this message out there. And if you didn't vibe with it, just keep that to yourself. I'm kind of new here, still trying to figure it all out. Talk to you soon, girl.